Mae Breslin, Carmel, California. It's tape number 430, February 29th, leap year, 1980, side one. I mentioned the leap year because I thought maybe this was the opportunity for researchers to get one more extra day during the year to cross-file and put information away. We're always short of time, but you can turn it around and say that it's one more extra day of news that you have to compile and put away in a world that is spinning too fast. There's just too much news to cross-file and assimilate the way it should be done in order to come up with some of the answers to questions that are being asked today. I've been accused on radio talk shows and also on the tape sometimes of throwing out names too fast and giving too much information in one tape. I apologize in advance. I'm going to be guilty of that on this tape. If you don't know the names, you'll have to go to your newspapers and do your homework because there's so much news and there isn't an opportunity or chance to develop each story that would take a tape in itself. So I'm just going to zip around like a roller coaster and hope you catch part of the ride and understand what I'm saying. I was invited to speak at Santa Catalina School this last Tuesday evening. And when one of the students invited me there, I was hesitant because 2 years ago when I was there, the students were very enthusiastic and interested and anxious to learn about history. And last year, they seemed to be getting into that complacency and apathy with political problems and weren't too interested. So when I was invited this year, I felt that maybe it wasn't even worth the effort, although I shouldn't feel that way because whenever you reach young people like that, this is a high school for girls, college preparatory, private school, Catholic school in the area. And when you're reaching young people, you just never know what seeds are being planted for people to become curious and ask questions when they get older. And the young woman who invited me asked me to come, and I expressed my feelings about the way the students were going. And she said, oh no, from 2 years ago when you were there, we started a social studies discussion group. And we read the newspapers and books, and we're trying to read information in addition to our regular studies and keep up with these matters. So with that, I said, of course, then I'll come. And this young lady is going to Georgetown University next year and wants to go into the State Department and is very interested in the book list that I have and the research and the radio shows I do here. And the students this year, particularly the war hangover and the draft and the possibility they're going into the Army, and the abscam and so much corruption, they were very enthusiastic. And I think it's important to reach to these people. Of course, the theme that I was talking about with them was on how to read the newspaper and how to think for yourself. As soon as they graduate, most of these are seniors. They were juniors and seniors. Throw off just about everything your parent, your priest, your teacher, minister, congressman, has told you, and go out and figure it out for yourself, because even though they may mean well, they haven't figured out a lot of things that the young people today are going to have to figure out. And I gave them different newspaper articles, the same article in the Washington Post that was in the San Francisco Chronicle, and showed the difference in the parts that were deleted, or Jack Anderson article on the Monterey Peninsula in the Herald that's deleted from the San Francisco Chronicle or the Washington Post, and show them how even when you're taking one newspaper, a lot is deleted. And then we did quickly a summary of from the John Kennedy assassination up through the Jonestown massacre, and I emphasized how important it was that these people don't turn their backs on these deaths and don't say, well, that Kennedy case was 16 years ago and they will never find the answers, or Jonestown was a bunch of black people, mostly black, who looked for an answer to life, an easy out, and went down to Guyana. And I emphasized that there were 120 white brainwashed assassins out on the streets from Jonestown, that they were going to have to live with those kinds of people that were brainwashed killers, and that this had been testified. A man named George Burdes had testified before Congress. And it was reported last May in the newspaper that there were from Jonestown, this basketball squad probably is part of it, and the people that turned these bodies upside down and then left the nurse and the people that turned them and took the boat to Barbados and escaped and went over to Venezuela, that there were these trained assassins that were brainwashed. There were a white entourage that could run places like Dachau and Auschwitz, and that they shouldn't pretend later when fascism comes that they didn't know, because I gave them newspaper articles to show how it was right there in the newspaper. The meeting was at 7:30 at night, and it went on till around 10:30, quarter of 11. But by the time I got from John Kennedy to Jonestown, just before we took questions, the history teacher was questioning me, the only teacher, faculty person in the room, with these young people, and taking a lot of notes and questioning how could the United States have gone in with troops and saved those people. We would be breaking law. And we had a dialogue, and I was really trying to tell him off, not in a very nice way. And I guess at the exact moment that we were talking about that, the Mills were murdered up in the Bay Area in San Francisco. Jeannie and Al Mills, who said on national television, who said on the radio, who published a book on Jonestown, that they were part of a hit list that would be murdered. And just at the time that I was speaking to these young people, at the exact moment about the hit squad, the Mills were murdered in the Bay Area. Now, because I've done so many tapes on Jonestown, I'm going to get back to the Mills in a few minutes. I just want to say that I am going to get to that, but I want to bring up a few other deaths and matters before we get to them, because I don't want to lose them. The way the news is coming out, there's too much information. So I want to cover briefly a few quick stories so that you get a hold of them. And of course, I'm going back to the Charles Krauss article in Colonial Dignitat, the part that I left off last week, and do some more about this story that broke in the Washington Post last week that pertains also to Jonestown and these trained assassins and this Gestapo that's out on the loose. This is the 10th anniversary of the Isla Vista riots in Santa Barbara. That's when the students at the University of California had a curfew put on them at the time of the anti-war movement during the Cambodia bombings and the Kent State massacres, and the 1,000 faculty and students and others were put on this curfew. A nonviolent demonstration was placed. They refused to obey. Hundreds of people were beaten and tear gassed, and 600 were arrested. And then later, 11 students who were charged with burning the Bank of America proved conclusively in court that they were not involved. This was a counterintelligence event staged in California during the anti-war movement. Now, Ronald Reagan was governor of California at the time, and I bring up the 10th anniversary of Reagan because 10th anniversary of Isla Vista and Reagan's being governor, because at the time of this Isla Vista occurrence, Ronald Reagan said, with a violent confrontation from the sheriff's department, which later turned out to do all the brutality, it was Sheriff Peter Pitch's department, the same man that created the Manson family and was responsible for the death of Sharon Tate and LaBianca's and everybody in the Tate home. The sheriff's department, Peter Pitch's of Los Angeles, California. Well, he set up the confrontations up in Isla Vista, and Ronald Reagan, the governor, was quoted as saying, "If it's to be a bloodbath, let it be." And with that, the sheriff's department went crazy. And as I say, they arrested 600 people, and many of them were beat up and hurt. It was a terrible tragedy for a nonviolent demonstration. It was Ronald Reagan's answer to somebody like Mahatma Gandhi, who wanted and taught nonviolence in India, and he said, "Bring on the bloodbath." That's the man that won the New Hampshire primaries this week. Mr. George Bush, who isn't out of the running yet because Reagan's an old man and could get an MK Ultra treatment or a stroke or a trip over a shoelace, and neither one of them is good. I'm not pushing for either of these dogs. George Bush had a press conference this last week at a gathering in Florida, of course, and he told them the United States must recognize it cannot always impose its morality on other countries. "We're a moral country," he said, "and we have to deal with the world as it is. And if we press our friends for change and change and change so much faster than their system can take, we sometimes wake up with friends replaced that are less good, something worse in terms of human rights." George Bush was director of the Central Intelligence Agency when agents from Chile, Colonial Dignitat, working with Operation Condor that set up headquarters in Florida, the same state that he's talking to about morality, were ordered to kill Orlando Letelier and Sandra Moffat in Washington, D.C., and they've done other murders in the United States. These assassination teams are rampant, and what he calls not imposing our morality means we can't tell them to stop killing. As head of the CIA, he worked closely with Mr. Somoza from Nicaragua Just this week, a trial is going on of Anastasia Somoza's National Guard in Nicaragua. There's a group of people that haven't been murdered. There's 7,800 alleged war criminals that were part of Somoza's team, and one man has offered to testify in return for some special treatment before this tribunal that's taking place. Somoza is now down in Paraguay with Mengeles and Stroessner and Bormann and the other Nazi gang. He's fled down there. But at this trial, this former guardsman, his name is Gerardo Leiva. He's 30 years old. He was telling about the crimes that Somoza did. And Somoza graduated from the United States West Point, and all of his police were trained by the United States CIA in Panama and in the United States for torture. He goes on to say that they used a Korean mercenary they brought over, among some of the things that they did, who tortured peasants. After they tortured peasants, they took the bodies of the peasants that were tortured, and they killed them, and they fried them, and then they fed them to their dogs. I'm reading a United Press story. The Korean, one of them was named Chino. He drove nails through the noses of the peasants. He tortured at the National Guard command post 210 miles north of Managua. The former officers are still in prison, but he testified about them. He said peasants were forced to dig trenches that became their mass graves and then shot them to death when they were finished digging. If it looks like a Nazi, if it's directed by a Nazi, if it acts like a Nazi and is smelt by a Nazi, it's not neo-Nazi. Somoza and Bush and Colonia Dignitat and the whole killer team have worked together hand in glove. Going back to the testimony of this man in Nicaragua, he said other forms of torture on peasants included rape, studded iron balls that swung against victims, electric shock to the genitals, and carving out chunks of flesh of live victims. Medina said men, women, and children and peasants were tied up, blindfolded, and thrown from helicopters. That's a trick that our William Colby did in Southeast Asia. That was the Phoenix program, to take people and throw them out of American-made Bell Hughes aircraft, Textron, helicopters, to throw people out, whole families blindfolded out of helicopters. That's the testimony out of Nicaragua. And this is the statement, the campaign statement of George Bush. Leave them alone at their morality, and we can't press our friends to change. Another dog who works with that team that I mentioned briefly is having been arrested in the, or named, he's going to be arrested in the Abscam scandal. And I want to do some of that on the other side of this tape is Representative Murphy. And I mentioned on a tape several weeks ago that Murphy was a member of the Pahlavi Foundation with the Shah of Iran and got him tax-deductible property in New York City and worked closely with the Korean Korea Gate officials and with Somoza. Went to West Point, an undergrad school, prep school with Somoza before Somoza went down to Nicaragua. And up through the time that Somoza left, Murphy was with him when he left. Murphy was interviewed last June when there was an uprising there, and when ABC TV photographed Bill Stewart, a newspaper reporter. He was murdered by the Somoza guardsmen in Managua. And Representative Murphy's quotation was, Stewart shouldn't have been there in the first place. And Murphy was just trying to cover up the murder. He made it justifiable, and that if you're in the wrong place, then you're going to be shot. The news people shouldn't even be covering what's going on in Nicaragua. That's an American newspaper man. Murray Kempton, quotation from the Washington Post, described Murphy as more susceptible to the attractions of foreign tyrants than Oscar Wilde ever was to bellboys. That is Representative Murphy, John Murphy, who has been caught up in the Abscam net, close links to Chemisol Corporation in New York City, which could be a dummy front. They're going investigating that as a source for his becoming suddenly wealthy, ties to Korea, the Shah of Iran, and Nicaragua. Murphy's had a bad year. All of his friends seem to have been gone, and now he's arrested. There is some justice, I suppose, after all. Last week, I talked on the tape about a trial going on in Philadelphia of Francis J. Sheeran, a leader of the Teamsters Union, who had been charged by a government informant and a Teamster, man that worked with the Teamsters, of having set up two murders specifically, four attempted murders, two arsons, and embezzlement of Teamsters funds. The case was going on in Philadelphia, and the man who was whistling or singing on these stories, Charles Allen, mentioned giving money, the Teamsters, to John Mitchell, and this also involved murders in the Southwest of high-up officials that were part of the Teamster organization. Well, I have to inform you this week that Mr. Francis Sheeran has been acquitted of all charges. The next step is that the informer who blew the whistle, Charles Allen's life insurance, isn't worth a wooden nickel. In a few more weeks or a year, you'll see that Charles Allen was dead, but the man who specifically testified against him, and a trial was conducted in Philadelphia, which I'll go into later. The policeman in charge of the Abscam investigation in New York said he worked in Philadelphia a few years and it was a cesspool. He went on to New York to do some interesting cases, such as indicting Michael Sindona, whose trial is going on now, and Mr. Scotto, friends of the White House, and Jimmy Carter, both men linked to the Vatican money, and he also was the chief in New York investigator to meet the Jonestown defendants when they came in, and then later all the FBI papers were destroyed. Some get caught and some get away. We'll do more about that, but there's interesting links of the Jonestown defendants to the Vatican story, to the Scotto, the organized crime, the Gambino family, the Abscam, the gun running, you see, and the narcotics traffic down in Jonestown, too. It will all come together in our lifetime, but I just want to say that Francis Sheeran has been acquitted of the two murders, the four murder attempts, the extortion, the whole thing, out free, ready to work again. There's a very important trial going on in Los Angeles, particularly in lieu of the FBI trying to get a handle on organized crime. This has to do with crime families up in San Jose. A murder took place October the 11th, 1977. Peter Catelli was murdered, and his father was shot and left for dead, survived, and he is attempting to prosecute the heads of the mozzarella cheese, the organized crime under the guise of a cheese factory up in the Bay Area. The main defendant in the case, Salvatore Marina, who is charged with shooting both the fatal shot of Peter, who died, and of his father, was taken out of the case, separated from the other defendants this week because two of the attorneys are sick. One, James Marks, the younger attorney, the attorney for Marino, said that he is suffering congestive heart failure and he has to take a rest. And then another attorney, Frank Glenn, a second attorney, said that he can't take over the case because he's had two heart attacks suffered since last summer. So the main defendant in these murder and attempted murder charges, and they do go to the highest echelons of organized crime throughout California or the United States or linking even abroad. As the cases got going and their arrests made, they took two attorneys who evidently have had heart seizures or attacks since the arrest, and now the one defendant has been separated because of these cases. I bring this up because there's so much of these attorneys either being murdered or getting heart disease, and the case is put off or dropped, or it's a diversionary. In this case, both attorneys are suffering from heart disease at this time. I mentioned last week that Mickey Zaffaroni, who dropped out of a heart attack just when the FBI agents were coming to him on a multi-billion-dollar porno industry. Another primary witness that dropped dead. I mentioned him on the tape last week. Jack Anderson, February 26, 1980, has a long article about Zaffaroni, who owns a place in Washington, D.C. called the Playhouse and the Pussycat Theater in New York City, which is a cover of the Mafia's main distribution of pornographic movie. And it's linked. Zaffaroni is a captain in the Banana Mafia family. Now, the case in California that I just mentioned is linked to the Banana family, too, the murders and the cheese factory out in San Jose, California. You see, the FBI is closing in, and the Abscam story is not a fake. It is not something to just get Democrats. This is very important, and that's why I want to bring out these cases, even if I don't get to all the Abscam now, because these witnesses are dying like mad. This particular Zaffaroni was wanted for shakedowns, extortion, and so forth, and they describe his business as being the third largest income maker for La Cosa Nostra. First there's gambling, then there's narcotics, and then there's pornography. Well, you may say, if pornography is over on Broadway in San Francisco or on 42nd Street in New York, and I don't want to see a movie, that's their business. Pornography isn't just that. It's kidnapping women. There's a case in Los Angeles where 30, 40, 50 women have been discovered to be dead in the pornographic racket. It's child pornography photographing 3- and 4-year-olds and child prostitution of boys and women and deaths that accompany it and extortions and blackmail and the promotion of human lives. This is what was going on in Panama and Havana before Fidel Castro kicked the whole gang out. But pornography isn't a question of taste of two adults making a decision to see a movie. Pornography is rearrangement of lives over and over again. Jack Anderson mentions that Deep Throat, a fairly innocent pornographic movie, made $50 million last year. I just saw a large article on Linda Lovelace, and she lives on welfare, so the United States are paying taxes to support her and her husband and her child. She can't seem to earn a living, and she's living in some kind of suburb. A long article about her. She's living on welfare, and you and I pay for her, and they've made $50 million so far, and they'll pull in another $50 million on the picture. It is literally slavery, exploitation, and they don't even give back a fair shake to the people who make it for them. But this feeds organized crime to bring in more drugs, to bring in more crime, to pay off more police, more congressmen, more justices of the Supreme Court, going right up to, like Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was discovered by Murray Chotiner with his links to organized crime. So just as the FBI closing in, and Zaffaroni, one of the king men, he too has a heart attack. It was a murder in Beverly Hills last May 23rd, 1979, and it had to do with a woman who was on the jury hearing the Iranian riots or the possible deportation of Iranians at the time that the Shah of Iran's sister was in Beverly Hills. And this woman was Cotsen, Mrs. Cotsen, C-O-T-S-E-N, was on the jury, grand jury, or the Beverly Hills inquiry into this matter. And somebody came in her home wearing a skiing mask and killed her and killed their son and a guest in the home also. The wonderful Beverly Hills police that's worked with Jack Eggers and the drug connections and the Hollywood drug connections and kept them very well protected all these years. The Beverly Hills police went over to Switzerland to interview a man, and just hours before he was being interviewed by the Beverly Hills police, he, in quotes, apparently killed himself. That's the way Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend, George De Morenschild, hours before the House Select Committee was to see him in Florida, he apparently killed himself, never mind all the discrepancies. Well, the police chief, Lee Tracy, went over to Switzerland, and the murder was in May 26th. The man's been dead since October 15th, 1979, and now the case is closed. The Associated Press says, Belgian blamed for Beverly Hills slaying. The police say the business rival killed a man's family. Another article this week, dead man accused in 3 Beverly Hills slayings. Well, what else is new? A Belgian businessman named Eric Arne Tall, alone, according to the police reports, after he was dead, killed his longtime rival's wife and child, and then killed himself. And it was a pharmaceutical company that they worked for. Just visualize this, that a drug company, a pharmaceutical company out of Belgium and Switzerland, that a man is competing with Lord Cotsen and his lawsuits involved for the drug company. So instead of killing his competitor, he kills the wife and the son and a friend in the house, and then he kills himself, which leaves the business open for his competitor. It doesn't explain why he would kill the wife and leave. Why didn't he just kill the man who had the lawsuit against him? So the way it reads, dead man is accused in Beverly Hills slayings. That's the easiest thing to do, and you get these instant apparent heart attacks, apparent shootings, apparent suicides, just when the case is getting hot. And again, on the trail of the Mills family, we'll get to that soon, just at the time that Leo Ryan has a press conference forcing Congress to go into the killings of Guyana because the CIA had a report that is dated that they had an agent at the airport when Leo Ryan was killed. Then 2 of the primary witnesses, Al and Jeannie Mill, that set up Jonestown with Tim Stone, were wiped out. No suspects. No son didn't hear anything. Nobody heard anything. Their brains were blown. Their daughter, bullets in her brain. But getting back to the Beverly Hills man, dead man accused because he's a longtime rival in a competitive pharmaceutical world. at a time when pharmacies, drug companies, and the scam is operating and closing in nationally and internationally. That's the way the Beverly Hills Police work, and I had to bring this to your attention. I save all these articles on these various, in quotes, unsolved murders, and I'm always glad to see that they're finally solved and that the dead man apparently did it. It's so neat and tidy, and I can put that under a completed file now. Completed, my eye. It'll be open for lots of years to come, and it will reappear again. Talking about reappearing, one of my favorite stories broke in the Salinas, California, just Wednesday night. It isn't in any papers that we have around here yet. I did shows on KLRB. I might have been on tapes. I have to look back at the date. But I mentioned when the Glomar Explorer was built that it was built specifically by the School of Oceanography and Howard Hughes Company, CIA, to get stolen jewels that were taken on a Japanese ship, disguised as a Red Cross hospital ship that was sunk outside of Hong Kong and China during World War II, that took the crown jewels of the Tsar's family from Harbin. The jewels were sent to Harbin and then were picked up in Manchuria by Japan. And at the time, they thought Russia was going to come into Japan at the end of the war, before we dropped the atomic bomb to quickly end the war. These jewels were taken on a hospital ship and dumped. Now, that ship is being raised by China. It was in the paper last night, and I don't have all the details. A friend who lives in Salinas told me about it. The ship jewels are being brought up. They are equal to billions of dollars, and these very easily could prove that that sabotage Red Cross ship was done purposely. And by allowing Red China, after we recognized Red China and made a deal with them about rearming them, we may be allowing Red China to bring the money in, and that's a payment for them to go to war against Russia with us. Turn the ship over to them instead of giving them cash. And the School of Oceanography in San Diego, run by Charles Lindbergh's son and other scientists, is in on the bringing up of the jewels, but the jewels will belong to China, which is a payment of billions and billions. There's several billions of dollars, I don't have all the figures, of star sapphires, gold, diamond, and jewels. And this is what I believe are the Tsar's jewels and the wealth of Russia that could be taken to Manchuria, to Harbin, picked up by Japan, taken to China, that just last night broke in the news. And as I say, I file these articles way away, and years later the stories break. I'll have more on that for you next week, but I want to give an example of how I have endless patience, and you wait 2, 3, 5, 10, 12, 16 years, it fits together. And that's the fun of doing the research. Besides accounting all these horrible murders of witnesses, it's fun to do the research. Another quick murder at the time of Abscam that may or may not have something to do with it, I think it does, is an antique dealer, a former actor, Richard Coleman on 77th Street, who collected million-dollar paintings. He had a place called Possessions of Prominence where artwork of millions of dollars was not kept in public galleries for sale, and it was sold by special distribution. It'd be a wonderful way to unload stolen art that the Vatican and the Nazis had and stored away. It was to take it to private art dealers in private homes. And just at the time that the art story is breaking with Abscam, a Titian valued $2 million was in this home, and there's an inventory of art that's just being put together. Multi-million-dollar collection of art, and two men were murdered. They say the first story said they were robbed. The second said they weren't robbed. But the point is that in these private apartments in New York City, there's millions of dollars of art objects that siphon through. People don't know the origins, where they came from, or where they're going. While some people are trying to claim their family art treasures that were taken from them 30 years ago, and have never been found. These murders are interesting because, again, they come just at a time that Abscam and the story that I did on William Taub with the missing oil paintings from the Vatican, I did a tape on that, and then the next week the Abscam story break with missing paintings. And the Abscam story was a Rubens, the story of William Taub was a Rubens, and now this man who was murdered and his friend have millions of dollars in private apartment in New York City where people can view. Everything is there. There is for sale except a chair. Very convenient place to sell. You don't have to catalog it, have public see it. Just a handful few of select people can take it and put it away. And, of course, these Arab art collectors, some disguised as Abscam and other real ones, can just take that and salt it all away in Saudi Arabia or other places until the Holocaust or the next war is over, and then surface with these valuable paintings. They have the cash and the means, and there's a traffic of these paintings that are high items. And so just last week, the art dealer and his buddy were killed. Another famous murder, Don Bowles, the reporter. I mentioned his name briefly last week on the tapes. He lived in Phoenix, Arizona, and he was exposing land frauds of youths and organized crime in the state of Arizona, the youth organization Organized Crime. On the other side of this tape, before we get to Jonestown and some an ab scam and some other matters, I do want to briefly mention three other deaths that were in the news this week, and one of them is the release of two men, Max Dunlap and James Robeson, from charges of murder of Don Bowles. They were convicted, and now they've been cleared that conviction's been reversed in that case. And what else is new? We'll do more on the other side.